I'm here with Julian Ankeny. Julian is a tribal member of the Nimiipuu tribe. She teaches creative writing and Native American literature and co-teaches Nimiiputemt, language, reclamation, revitalization, and learning at Washington State University. We're recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day today. There's a lot of issues in the Native community in the country today, and particularly in Washington and Oregon. And you know, there's no way that we can hit them all, and there's no way we can go into depth in them all. But we'd sure like you to know what some of the issues are that trouble us and are working on us, and hope that you join us to try and really help address some of these situations. And some of those are murdered and missing Indigenous women and murdered and missing Indigenous men. Education. We've always had an issue with it, but we're really having deepening issues in that. We might want to talk about since time immemorial, which is a mandated history taught in the school systems in Oregon and Washington, which is a big first. And Title VI Indian education, which is not being taught in the school system, even though in many school systems in the area, even though it's federally mandated. Healthcare in Indian country is absolutely abysmal, and we think we need to talk a little bit about that. And environmental justice and climate collapse, and what that means to everybody, not just tribal entities, but certainly to the fish and to the water, and to the orcas and everything around us. Julian, would you like to break in here and address any of this? I know you've had some experience, as we all have, with different parts of this, and we'd sure like to know what your thoughts are.
Yes, thank you, Robin. Inamunik Dwas, Julian Ankeny. My name is Julian Ankeny, and I am a Nimiipuu, Nez Perce, as the French fur trappers named us long ago. Nez Perce is basically a translation of the vernacular back in the day, nose pierce. So Nez Perce, that's the name that stuck, but we actually refer to ourselves as Nimiipuu, the people. Missing and murdered Indigenous women and men lies very, very close to my heart. It's not only an epidemic, but it's almost an invisible epidemic up until recently. All, you know, tribal nations know that this is a problem, and we've been speaking up about it for a long time. We just have, a lot of people have felt like they have never been heard until now. So it gives us hope. So it's just not a story of, you know, of loss, but also of hope. So with that, these are also stories that need to be told, right? Because a lot of missing and murdered Indigenous women and men don't get national attention or even public attention. A lot of the times, a lot of these stories just get swept under the rug. So we need to put life back into these stories. And we have a Nimiiputemt, Nez Perce language word that means life, and it's Wakiswit. So Wakiswit, life. So we need to give life to these stories. Just to give you a few statistics on missing and murdered Indigenous men and women. It's just not, you know, women that go missing. There's so many men that too, they also go missing. From 2019, there was 5,500 reported missing Indigenous women in the U.S. And those are the only reported numbers. There's so many unreported cases all over the U.S., as well as cases of men who also go missing. The summer of 2018, my brother, Michael Murphy, he just vanished. He went missing, and we have not been able to find him yet. And I have had to work with two different law agencies within the Valley because of jurisdiction issues and different things. At first, they wouldn't even believe that he was missing. They're like, well, you know, is he just running from cops or something? And we're like, okay, dude, he's missing. So, you know, at first we weren't even taken seriously. And a lot of these cases and a lot of these missing people aren't taken seriously. 4 out of 5 Native women experience violence towards them. Native women experience violence 10 times higher than the national average. And 90% of that violence is actually from non-Native partners. So it's a really big
right
epidemic.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I'm sorry about your brother. It seems to that everybody in Indian country has been touched by this with a relative or a friend, and it's something that really needs to be dealt with. And another thing I think is we're still having children stolen from us through adoption and through the legal system. And even though this is supposed to be federally mandated to not be legal, you know, it's still happening, and we need to address that as well. We were talking a little about education too, and about how really bad it is in Indian country to try and get an education, whether that's at kindergarten through 12th grade or higher education, and what that means. I touched a little bit on that since time immemorial, which the Native Caucus of Washington in particular was particularly helpful in getting passed, and in Oregon, Washington, it's both passed, and Washington State University is helping in those areas. The local tribes get to decide what that is in their areas, that curriculum, and trying to get that into the schools and get that to where teachers can grasp it and be comfortable with it is an effort that we're trying to do. I think it's an important thing, but I think it's also important to know that, you know, that's a few minutes of every quarter or every semester that these kids are getting it. It's a start, but it's just a start. So, you know, ask your kids what they're learning in school and try and go to your school boards and to your teachers and find out what that is. And let's, since we got that foot in that door, let's try and open that door and try and make it a real history project that people know what their neighbors and what the first people here in this country, their history. What's your experience, Julian, with your education? And just to kind of hit a few short highlights of some troubles that you might have had and or are having, either as a teacher or as a student.
Yes. So I actually didn't go to a tribal school on a reservation, although my children that I have now do, three of which are adopted. So I actually have four children. That issue of, you know, adoption and the Indian Child Welfare Act also hits very close to home, because there are more, you know, Indian children that actually need foster care than there are readily available Native families that can actually take them in due to a variety of different circumstances. That issue combined with a lower, compared to the national education rate, it's much lower in Indian country due to so many biopsychosocial events that impact schooling. So for me, living off the reservation, I actually experienced lots of systematic racism as a child in high school. I actually experienced the most systemic racism was when I got into higher education and was juxtaposed to all these other people's beliefs about, you know, how Indians should behave was a vast contrast to how I am and how I hold myself. So it's
right, because all Indians are the same, of course. You know?
Right. I had one lady talk to me once and couldn't figure out what I was. And she's like, "Well, I know you're not Mexican because your English is impeccable."
Oh,
and I was like, "Oh my goodness. I can't believe she said this to me," you know. And I was like, "I'm actually Native American." She's like, "Oh, well, I could tell you had brown skin." I'm like, "Oh Lord."
Oh, yeah.
And not only that, a lot of European Americans don't know all the genocide. They don't know about the Trail of Tears or all of these stories like the U.S. cavalry coming in and cutting out the vaginas of women and girls and stretching them over their saddle horns as souvenirs. And just all of these like atrocities leading up to boarding schools, which is a whole nother issue. And there's so much grief and historical trauma in those different stories. It's history, but this is history that we're actually hearing from our grandparents and our great aunties.
Right. I'm Cheyenne and Lakota. I'm enrolled at Pine Ridge. And when we're talking about these things in this historical aspect, people keep saying, "Well, it was so long ago, it doesn't matter anymore." Well, I heard these stories from my grandmother and great grandmother, and great grandmother was there. That puts it into perspective. You know, if you can touch someone and you talk to someone, that's recent enough history for me to have issues with it and to keep that. And you know, there's always remember the Alamo or this and that, but apparently Indian issues die 30 minutes after the atrocity was done. Appreciate what you're talking about there. We have some other issues that are up right at the moment too, which are the land grant universities that took thousands and thousands and thousands of acres from natives and maybe in your state or out of a state, and they used that land for these universities that natives certainly, particularly at first, weren't allowed to enter into or become educated from, and when they were educated, largely it was to become farmhands and to laundresses and the more menial and labor type jobs instead of lawyers and doctors and so on. So we call it the land grab universities, trying to address that as well. And you know, we hope that people kind of start considering where their education came from, and how that was financed was largely on the backs of these Native American, and what that means and what it means in the future. There are cultural differences when you're in these school systems that we need to be dealing with and need to talk about. And we need to talk about some how to make parity in this, in education, and how important that is to try and fill the jobs in our tribal entities and just in general to raise up the quality of education for our people. Title VI Indian education, like I said, in Clark County hasn't even been done for 4 years or so because the school system just ignores it, even though it's not an unfunded mandate, but they just don't want to deal with it. So, you know, we need to work on some of that. Julian, you've had some experience in the just atrocious state of healthcare for Native Americans. Can you give me a little bit of an idea of what your situation has been?
Yes. So I do have personal anecdotal stories. And then I also know so many people who have experienced just the utmost atrocities from the healthcare industry. My first pregnancy, I was pregnant with twins, and I didn't even know that I was supposed to get prenatal care. I was actually living in Seattle at this time. I never received any prenatal care. And then my water broke, and I didn't know my water broke because I didn't have any prenatal care. I was really young. I was 19 years old. So I went to the emergency room and they sent me home. They didn't do a pelvic exam or anything. And then later that night, it was about 11 o'clock, and I went to the bathroom and I felt something, and I was like, well, that felt weird. And so I, you know, reached my fingers up my vagina a little bit, and I felt little toes. And then I reached up a little farther and I felt a little tiny foot about the size of my thumb. And that's when I knew, you know, I needed to call the ambulance. Wow. And I, you know, I was rushed to the hospital in an ambulance, and it was very, very traumatic. And I remember telling myself, I'm never going to have this happen to me again. I need to know what these doctors are saying. So it actually made me get my certification as a certified nursing assistant. And then I got pregnant with my daughter, who actually passed away when she was 18 months old from SIDS. But with her, I was actually life-flighted from Lewiston to Spokane because, my first pregnancy, my water broke a little too soon. So I was flown up there. And so that, again, was a very traumatic experience. And then my third pregnancy, actually, I had a botched cesarean section. Because I had all this medical knowledge now that, you know, I was what they do when you have a C-section, they secure your arms. So you kind of feel like Jesus, right? So your arms are secured. You can only see the roof or the ceiling of the operating room. And the doctor took so long extracting or putting me together, whatever he was doing, that I could actually feel my body going into shock. And the epidural started wearing off, and I could actually feel the doctor, you know, pushing my organs back into my stomach. So yeah, very, very traumatic things that happened. My kids' mom, actually, she over in the Toppenish Valley of Washington, actually got into a car wreck, a pretty, you know, a violent car wreck where she broke her collarbone and she had massive head trauma where she was in and out of consciousness. And one hospital over there just sent her home. And then the second hospital that she went to, because she was still blacking out and stuff the next day, and she had blood all caked in her hair, they actually said, well, if you were at this other hospital, where's your record? This hospital says they have no record of you being there. And she's like, well, that's impossible. I was just there, you know, a few days ago. And they said that the hospital said they didn't have her record. The only thing that made them believe her was she actually had her discharge paperwork still in her purse. So
the death rates on Indian reservations are incredible. I think the life expectancy is on my reservation, I think, is around 50 something for both men and women. We just got a dental clinic in Portland just a couple of years ago. That's what, the seventh or eighth largest Native community in the country. People are dying right and left, particularly on the reservations. And even in the Indian health clinics here, there's no equipment in there. Everything, we have to go out for everything. And if you have no insurance, you're at the mercy of doctors that are willing to serve you for free for anything that's other than kind of Band-Aids. And you go in and they'll tell you, yeah, you're sick, and kind of what you're sick of, more or less. And then, sometimes you're on your own. So these are situations that we have to deal with. I hear you're having a gig going on in Berkeley, California. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so October 29th, that you have to register before the event to attend the event. 4 to 5 Pacific time, October 29th. The full description of the event, this event is presented alongside the Hearst Museum's current online exhibit, Cloth That Stretches, Weaving Community Across Time and Space, which explores textiles as a site of identity, formation, and cultural resilience. At a time when people are divided by many challenges facing our communities today, a pandemic, racial injustice, climate change, this program offers a rare chance to build community through the tangible objects in the Hearst Museum's collection, and sometimes intangible, the language and story, and inspire audiences to help the world around them through creative and introspectional approaches. We are going to be in conversation with Professor Beth Piotote, and we are going to read some poetry about weaving.
You know, the last thing I think we need to touch on, we've only got a minute, so I'm just going to say, you know, the climate is collapsing. We need to take care of the water. We need to take care of the air. They're the same thing. We need to do right by all the other living things around us in the world. It's our duty to treat water with respect. It's our duty to treat the world with respect and each other with respect. And we're going to die if we don't do that. The world is going to die as we know it. And it's disrespectful. It's something that we have to change. And I want to thank you, Julian, for all of your great words and appreciate it. And I wish we had more time to get into depth. And hopefully we're going to have you back and we're going to talk about a lot of these things in depth. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Robin and Desiree. And I just wanted to say one more thing. Listen to Indigenous people.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you.